Hello, good morning, welcome. I am Samuel Trapp. This is International Flavor. You are listening to Damn Radio, coming to you live from the Lake Ozark Real Estate of the Art Studio. Appreciate you being with us today. And, geez, what a weekend, huh? I feel like I've been running my little butt off the entire weekend. Well, maybe because I was. Now, there's a lot of things going on, and we've had two of the most serious, drone attacks from the Ukrainian side and missile attacks from the Russian side since the beginning of the, let's call it what the West calls it, just so we feel like we know what it is. Vladimir Putin's unprovoked total war of destruction against the Ukrainian democratic state or something like that. Throw whatever anti-Russia, anti-Putin, pro-Ukraine, and whatever narrative you want to throw in there. Unprovoked war, right? Unprovoked military action against the good people of Ukraine, and Zelensky, is Churchill number two, as there's one of our guys I listen to all the time gets to refer to him as. And there's been a lot of destruction, and I want to get into some of that. I want to get into some wonderful music that I happen to like. There's another couple of newbies that have come out that I wish to share with you, should that come up. And let's see if there's any good headlines before we get into the goodies that I have in store for you. Where are the good headlines? Let's get there. Apparently, we have hundreds of migrants doing the same thing again, and I'm not sure what pushed it, but this now they're calling it Ceuta. I forget how to pronounce it, but they're calling it again. They have video of it. Thousands are stranded and following another influx from Morocco that overwhelms local authorities, and hundreds of Moroccan migrants have protested in Spain's North African enclave, demanding asylum as thousands remain stranded in the area following mass border crossing last month. So this was on July 30 and 31. An estimated 72,000 migrants entered, equivalent to about 70% of the population of 84,000. And while most returned shortly afterward, there's 7,000 to 9,000 that stayed there. And the reception centers, hospitals, law enforcement, and it's quite a dispute over the fate of these migrants. The mayor, Mayor President Juan Jesus Vivas has called for asylum claims linked to this surge to be rejected and for migrants to be returned to Morocco. Spanish Interior Minister Fernando Grande Marlaska backed the hardline approach, saying regular arrivals would not be allowed to remain, reach mainland Spain, or obtain legal status except in very rare cases of extreme vulnerability. Judicial associations are pushing back, saying claims have to be assessed individually and that illegal entry doesn't forfeit the right to seek asylum. Sound familiar? Amid this row, several hundred migrants staged a sit-in at a popular beach on Sunday and urged the authorities not to return them to Morocco. Footage shows protesters waving Spanish flags saying, "We need asylum." The video is kind of interesting here. We Moroccans are protesting without food and water, and we will continue sitting here, one protester said. Separate footage shows security forces detaining several migrants on the beach, though it is unclear if they were part of the protest or not. The initial surge came shortly after Spain's Supreme Court ruled that migrants intercepted at sea while trying to reach Ceuta or Melilla could not be immediately deported. Spanish officials accused trafficking networks of exploiting this ruling through viral social media posts falsely claiming the country's borders were open. Another wave of 300 or so migrants attempted to enter on Saturday, but was stopped by Moroccan police, according to state broadcaster Medi1 TV. Another 61 Moroccans accused of facilitating this attempt were arrested, said the same broadcaster. Brussels, now multiple EU members, have pinned the blame for the crisis on Madrid and its permissive approach toward migration. Leaders of 22 EU nations have accused Spain of undermining the bloc's security in a letter in August, several calling for the exclusion from the Schengen borderless travel zone. So I don't know if you know this, but a Schengen is the visa that covers all of Europe. So if you get a visa in Spain, you can go anywhere in the Schengen zone in Europe. And so and all you got to do is get in, one country will give it to you, and then you have it for all of them. And a lot of them dislike this because it means that a migrant can come in from Morocco or somewhere else and just end up in Germany, end up in Poland, end up wherever the Schengen covers. And they can just jump between each one, taking, French 3 months of free social stuff, and then heading into Germany. This is what the Ukrainians are doing. They're bouncing around from country to country to country and taking the free stuff each particular country offers, because the EU as a whole has adopted the Schengen. And this has been going on for a while. And then they've created their own problem, basically. And now the rest of them are blaming Spain. You know, well, just because they end up coming to Spain first, you know, and because Spain has these enclaves in on the African northern coast, like Ceuta or Ceuta or however you say it, and they're pretty permissive in the first place, and now they got 7,000 to 9,000 just sitting there, not being granted the ability to go anywhere. And the Spanish Supreme Court has made that okay. So they got their own problem. Italy introduced temporary checks on travelers arriving from Spain on August 1, and France has tightened its own border security. Madrid is hitting back, saying that the measures and criticism are selfish, polarizing, and unlawful. And it retaliated against Italy's move by imposing reciprocal restrictions on travelers arriving from Italy into Spain starting August 8th. Brussels has largely sought to sit out this dispute. European Commission has refrained from penalizing Spain over Ceuta and praising Madrid for preventing irregular migrants from reaching mainland Europe, keeping them all in Africa, right? while dismissing calls for Schengen restrictions, but it has also stopped short of offering Madrid any sort of backing, so far limiting its response to sending a team of migration experts. Oh, yeah, that's the government for you. Always send a team of experts, and those experts, boy, they'll know some things, right? And they can chat it up for you. Migration is an increasingly explosive issue in the EU, but we'll see what happens this year during elections and see if that has any impact on it this year. We'll see. Critics say Brussels' asylum protections, burden-sharing agreements, and expanded legal migration pathways have created all kinds of incentives for illegal immigration. And, it's interesting. And, boy, the trash on the beaches is disgusting that you can see on there. So I watched and listened to a rather interesting interview with Sergei Viktorovich Lavrov the other day. And I think the interview was actually given on Thursday after my last program, so it had already been, I don't know what it had. It was too late in the week for me to get into it. Oh man, missing a pair of glasses. Somebody usually leaves a pair hanging out here. Hold on. Yep, don't know who I'm stealing them from, but they're looking like they might work for me. So let's see. We're going to share with you. So a lot of there's been some interesting international events lately. The fact that England has provided the ability for Ukraine to strike deep inside of Russia, allegations that the U.S. is doing the same, aren't very well thought of inside of Russia. But Rubio has said some things, and probably I don't want to shortchange Sergei Viktorovich's interview. They even got into a few, I don't know, personal details about him. And let's see if I can come up with this. Where are we with the old Sergei Viktorovich? Because this is important, I think. And the Lavrov interview, there were a number of questions, and I'm going to provide for you pretty much all of it, his interview, because he is one of the most consequential foreign ministers on the planet. And he's been around for a long time. He is very well spoken. He's extremely consistent, and you can see, and watching him recently, you can see the, I don't know exactly even how to put it, consistent, cynical, you know, cynical is probably not the right word. I had a discussion several weeks ago about what my wife calls being tochny, and it's exact, being exact, and how Russians in general, and I hate, you know, I don't like generalizing, you know, if one is just, you can't, you're not supposed to generalize, but it's far more noticeable in the Russian public than it is with Americans. We're a little bit more free reign, you know. We roll with the punches, you know, more than Russians do. They're a little more wound up for the most part, and they expect things to be a certain way. If they're told they're going to be a certain way, we don't believe there. We believe that people are selling us something all the time anyway, and it's not going to be what people tell us. You know, the fluffing in sales, where you fluff or you pad what, you know, oh, gee, this car was owned by one little old lady that drove it, you know, back and forth to the grocery store, and that's all, put on 10 miles a week. She didn't drive anywhere. That is presumed to be puffing here. Well, in general, if they told you that in Russia, they'd go, that's not what you told me. and that isn't what you said. And we understand that it's just a sales pitch. You know what I mean? But Lavrov was asked, this interview was last week, like the 14th, I think it was. And basically, he gives he's a dry sort of guy. He's humorous if you take it in the dry sort of humor way, but he's very, very consistent. And I wanted to share with you his interview almost in its entirety here about what he said, because it's interesting. There's, I don't know if any of you know about what has happened in visiting of the Kuril Islands between Russia and Japan, and the uproar it has caused in some commentary that people are, you know, freaking out. Oh my God, Putin went to the Kuril Islands, and there's, and, well, they're Russian, and they have been since 1850 something. But there was, and I don't remember the exact treaty compromises that went through, but Japan no longer recognizes the treaty that the Russians have recognized since 1850. They went back to one prior to that, where Tsar so-and-so gave it to the islands to Japan. And so this dispute has been around, but it's 100 years old. It's nothing really recent. And but they're all call, everybody wants to call it disputed islands, okay? And I don't know. I don't care. I don't take a position on it. I'm just saying there's arguments for and against in both ways. And Putin went and visited these islands last week before, and spoke from there. And it pissed off the current leadership of Japan. Okay, and so they started with this question when they were talking about it. And basically, he said, Japan has named now, after Putin visits this island, or these islands, a string of islands, Japan has now named Russia a principal threat. You know, Russia, 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 Russia. Now they have one. Would this have happened under its prior leadership? And Lavrov says, he says, no, the current Japanese leadership, which he says is a, the guy's a completely a complete politician. He understood that the politician isn't the guy that was before, and he says that the leadership, the new leadership, instead believes that Japan's interests only should be pursued alongside the United States and through Japanese remilitarization. Are you watching this, by the way, worldwide, with the two big threats that are allegedly, you know, former threats that are being allowed to remilitarize, which is Japan and Germany? Japan is certainly remilitarizing, and Germany said in the last, Merz said in the last 2 weeks that he's going to make Germany the premier military force of Europe again. Now that's a big deal for the Russians, because they hear this and they hear, you know, Nazi German threat once again, especially with what's going on in Ukraine and the rampant nationalist and some say Naziist focus there. So Lavrov says he went to an ASEAN event, and the Japanese foreign minister, and here's, he was kind of sarcastic his whole way through this interview, because he gets tired of saying some of the same things over and over, and he has to keep on repeating them, but he's extremely consistent. But now he's starting to get a little bit, I don't want to say frustrated, but it's kind of a, okay, here we go again, you know, that he appears to be showing. And he said that after this, after the ASEAN event, the Japanese foreign minister announced publicly that he and Lavrov had discussed bilateral affairs and this situation in the region. But Lavrov says what actually happened was that during a ceremonial banquet, he said the only contact he had with the Japanese minister, that the Japanese minister came up behind him, touched him on the shoulder, and said, "Glad to see you," shook his hand, and walked away. And Lavrov's punchline, Lavrov says, and apparently that is now called discussing bilateral and regional issues. And then he says that recently a Japanese business delegation came to Russia with explicit instructions from Tokyo not to discuss any new projects with Russia. So I seem amused, you know, but he was kind of slightly amused and contemptuous, you know. It's like, psh, yeah, this is, well, what's the, this is diplomacy? You know, he's talking about this is diplomacy. It was a pretty good interview, and certainly that was the very first question. The second question had to do with the so-called shadow fleet, right? And many, many people, and I'm not alone in this, many people say the only thing that differentiates the shadow fleet from a real shipping company is the shadow fleet isn't insured by Lloyd's of London. That's they're only attacking ships not insured by Lloyd's of London. So the shadow fleet and what's going on with these is more and more around the globe. People are seizing these ships, selling the cargo, saying they're Russian shadow fleet, and giving the money to Ukraine. And all with completely outside of international law of the sea, but justified because they claim sanctions. Okay, and the only sanctions exist are either EU or United States sanctions. U.S. seized one or two of these way back when, in a year ago or so, but now they're more and more often doing it. Plus, the Ukrainians attacked all over the Azov Sea over the last, within the last 4 to 6 weeks, and destroyed hundreds of ships, upwards of 100, 100, 150, some say almost 200, grain vessels, cargo ships, oil ships in the Azov Sea. And now that Russia is retaliating in Odessa and basically blockading Ukraine's ability to send and receive, they're crying uncle. Wait a minute. We need to agree to let each other go. Well, yeah, Russia's going, well, yeah, but you already destroyed all of our fleet, basically, of merchant ships in the Sea of Azov. Why in the world would we agree now? And so that, with that as the backdrop, and the EU inspecting, as they call it, Russian commercial vessels, calling them a shadow fleet, this lady, the interviewer, said, what's really happening? Lavrov says, the shadow fleet has no basis in international legal rights. And that's true. And it is a made-up terminology invented by the EU. And his argument was that Brussels has transformed its own unilateral sanctions into something it treats as superior to international law. And Russians, you know, don't put up with that. And or don't buy into that. You know, they've so far, for the most part, been subjected to it. And according to Lavrov, vessels that refuse to obey EU restrictions are simply labeled members of a supposed Russian shadow fleet. And then he says European proposals contemplate stopping vessels, inspecting them, seizing the cargo and selling it, and giving the proceeds to Ukraine. He calls this razboy, and he calls it piratstva. Razboy means robbery, banditry is the literal translation, and piratstva is piracy. And then he delivers a warning because Putin did this last week. Putin said in an address last week, he said that Russia from now on, he sent a straight warning. And at one of the anniversaries of the VMF, the Navy, that he said Russia is going to respond zerkalno, which is like mirror-like, symmetrically. They're going to respond in kind, basically. And Russia is going to choose the targets itself, including vessels that operate in the interests of states that have made such practices official policy. So there was a ship seized, I want to say by Belgium, a month or so ago. So what Russia is saying is that when they can, they're going to seize a Belgian ship. And they haven't said they're going to do it. They said, if this continues to happen, we're going to do the same thing. And we're going to take your ships. We're going to inspect them with our Navy. We're going to seize them. We're going to sell the stuff. And we're going to keep the proceeds. And, you know, we're going to have our own sanctions against you the other way around. And Lavrov is just saying, well, Putin has already said this is what's going to happen. And this is much stronger than another complaint about sanctions. You know, so far they've been basically, here you go again with these sanctions, and, you know, they're hurting you more than they're hurting us. Well, now they're saying, well, we're going to take action, reverse, symmetrical. And Lavrov is arguing that the sanctions enforcement at sea risks crossing from economic coercion into something that Russia now treats as hostile maritime actions. And they're going to keep on doing it. And the lady says, yeah, but doesn't that mean we're stooping to the same level that they are? And says, you know, we have greater values. It was interesting to me that they're talking about Russian values and that we don't lower ourselves just because other people do. And she says, can Russia fight against such opponents without descending to their methods? And Lavrov says, we will not descend to their level, but Russia will make its own methods much tougher in destroying everything that sustains Kyiv's military machine from the West. And then he said something. He said, Russia is not going to stop merely because people are calling for it to stop. And Lavrov says Russia will only stop when there is a long-term, reliable, sustainable settlement of the whole process. And he explicitly rejects simply stopping at the existing line of contact. And his argument is that Russia's responsibility extends beyond today's immediate comfort zone or casualties to what he describes as the historical security of the Russian state. And this is part of my my exactness. They won't just agree to a ceasefire. A ceasefire is not settlement. They've been after settlement the whole time. And they've been extremely consistent on this point. And I've been talking about it here for at least 2.5 years. And this thing is 4.5 years in. And they have been remarkably consistent in saying that a ceasefire is not what we want. We want a settlement of the conflict. We don't want to just leave everything intact so that, you know, in a month, all you do is rearm and you start the war right up again. You know, that's the history in the Russian sea. And I think it's important to emphasize that point again from Sergei Lavrov, because they've been extremely consistent in that. And everybody wants to just say the word Russia rejected ceasefire, ceasefire, ceasefire. A ceasefire is not a settlement. You see that in Iran. And what, you know, this ceasefire BS is not a settlement. The MOU wasn't a settlement. It was, you know, oh, gee, 10 days off. Oh, gee, 60 days is up. Oh, gee, now we have to start again. And you get to reset the 60-day clock so you don't need congressional authority, right? And Lavrov says that ceasefire and peace are not equivalent propositions. Those are his words. And that's absolutely true. And nobody, if you don't understand where they're coming from, you're never going to understand why this war isn't over yet. Then he was asked, and I don't know if you saw it last week, but last week there was a German journalist who asked Zelensky, maybe it was 10 days ago, I don't know, but it was pretty recently, that a German journalist said to Zelensky, he said, how can the, and he's just a journalist, right? He said, how can we Germans help Ukrainians kill Russians. How can we help you kill the Russians? And that's exactly how he put it. And she says, she quotes that, and she says, "What is there any such thing as Western diplomacy anymore?" And Lavrov said that such a journalist should never be allowed to hold a media position, much less an official government one as this one holds. And then he broadened the issue to Germany under Merz and Germany's ambition, like I told you here 10 minutes ago, Germany's ambition to become Europe's leading military power again. And Lavrov focused on that word again. And his implication is that when a German leader talks about making Germany's, you know, making Germany Europe's dominant military power again, Russians hear historical echoes that Germans ought to understand. And he said that Vučić, who was in the room when this question was given, he was also asked, and he said, Vučić was stunned. He just looked like, and he couldn't believe that the German journalist asked it in that way. I mean, frankly, I couldn't either. It was ridiculous for it to be asked in that manner. And, you know, you could say, how can we help? But you don't say, how do we kill people for you? I think that is nonsense. And I happen to agree with Lavrov on that count. You know, that's again one of the points where he was basically sarcastic. Let's see. He asked another couple of questions about Vučić and then about Bulgarian President Roman Radev in the Coalition of the Willing. And then he gets to the important stuff that would matter to us anyway. Witkoff and Kushner keep failing to arrive in Moscow, was the question. Can either of them actually influence Trump? And so this is this part is interesting. Lavrov assumes, because he said so, they must have Trump's confidence because Trump entrusts them with these assignments. He said, Russia remains willing to talk to them. Putin remains willing to receive them. But the question is, what will they come to Russia with? Then he recounts a previous Witkoff mission. And when he talked, and this is pre-Alaska, okay? According to Lavrov, Witkoff brought a Trump proposal to Moscow before Alaska. Putin studied it and told Trump in Alaska, essentially, you sent us this proposal. I considered it. Some things require compromise, but I accept your proposal in the form in which you sent it. And then, according to Lavrov, there was a pause. That nothing happened after he came to Alaska. And by the way, that's a while ago now. And then what happened? Sanctions against Lukoil and Rosneft. European and NATO leaders, together with Zelensky, all hiked their little butts to Washington to talk Trump out of pursuing any further initiatives. They want this war. Then Rubio says America can't be a mediator because America supports Ukraine. Then Rubio said the opposite. Only Trump could bring Russia and Ukraine together and produce a settlement. And this is the cynical Lavrov. And he lays out this sequence and says, so which America are we allegedly negotiating with? The mediator? The Ukrainian supporter? A sanctions power? The party that's supplying weapons to Ukraine, the party supplying intelligence to Ukraine, or Trump's personal negotiating channels? Lavrov asked that question just the way I laid it out to you. He goes, who the heck are we supposed to talk to? The contradictions, he just listed them all out and said, well, you know, it's... we accepted. What more do you want, basically? And Putin said he would
start with that basis that Trump was going, then Trump didn't do anything about it. So what are Witkoff and Kushner allegedly going to show up with this time? It's going to be any different. Russia's not going to accept anything less than they already accepted. They've been pretty concrete about that, too. So what are we doing? And Lavrov is one of the reasons I think Lavrov is one of the best people to do this is I believe Lavrov to be absolutely, hands down, the most accomplished and successful foreign minister in the world. And arguably, Jai Shankar and I forget the guy's name in China are pretty good, too. But Jai Shankar, I'm generally impressed with as well. And, you know, Rubio, not so much. And that guy is a child compared to these two. And he's a definite neocon, and he just loves his war, and it's all about forcing people to do things, and that's it. And Lavrov has been, look, we've been pretty clear with what we're going to do. We accepted, thought there was going to be something happen when Trump was serious about all this. Turns out he's not. It's basically what he's saying. So cynical? I don't know. Confrontational? Didn't appear to be. He was just laying out the facts that they are. Who's in charge, basically? The mediator, which is Trump. His negotiating channel, his personal negotiating channel. You know, who is it? Witkoff, Kushner, what have they done? Not much. They've gotten rich. You know, now Kushner's brother is buying basketball teams and trying to buy FIFA percentages and Jesus, who knows what? These people, and we bitched about it when it was Hunter Biden getting rich, but we're not all that jazzed up about it if it's Trump connected people. Oh, they were rich anyway. Doesn't matter. And they know what they're doing where Hunter Biden didn't. Okay. So what do they know about owning a basketball team, you know? I suppose nobody does unless they have the money to buy one, right? Next question was, why doesn't Russia demand that the United States stop supporting deep strikes inside of Russia before negotiation? Because this is happening. There is no way Ukraine can pull off these deep strikes inside of Russia without U.S. assistance and intelligence. No way. And possibly without Starlink or Starshield, which is the military version, assistance. Now, over the weekend, they struck I think it's called Rassvet, I think, is sunrise. Rassvet is the name of the Starlink equivalent in Russia. And the place that manufactures the satellite rocketry to get them into the atmosphere, or low Earth orbit, was damaged severely over the weekend by Russian Ukrainian drone strikes. And allegedly, there were some pretty deep strikes in there, and I forget the name of the town, Samara, I think it is, where they attacked it over the weekend, and it was pretty damn destructive what they were able to hit. And it seems to me that that's a big Russian failure, and you're not seeing Russia talk too much about it, but the Ukrainian channels are all over about it and what they've done to it. And several commentators are saying that, Ukraine is truly frightened over this ability of Russia to be able to, because this will help support Russian strikes deeper and deeper inside of Ukraine, which they already have anyway with their ballistic missile programs and their other missile programs. But the drone stuff being done through Rosviet is what is very similar to what U.S. giving Ukraine the technology and access to Starlink or Starshield is allowing them to do inside of Russia. So the reporter mentioned the attacks against Russian oil refineries, small businesses, and ordinary people, and asks how come Russia doesn't give Witkoff and Kushner an ultimatum before any sort of negotiations. Well, first of all, Witkoff and Kushner haven't shown up anyway. And second of all, Lavrov says Russia doesn't issue ultimatums. Instead, they formally submit questions to the State Department through the proper channels and request explanations regarding American intelligence support. He says Russia believes the United States is involved far more deeply, including in the organization and the execution of strikes deep inside Russian territory against civilian objects, like Wildberries, places like that. And then he says, we will wait for an answer. And that's very much Lavrov. Well, you know, we've answered through the diplomatic channels, and now we'll wait for the answer. And now, you know what? I'll get into that after we take a very short break. I'm going to play a little bit of music, Faya, here. And let's see if we can get to where it is. Do-do-do-do-do. Is that the one I want? No, ma'am, that is not the one I want. But we're gonna get to it. Here it is. Enjoy.
Without your voice, like I never really had a choice. It took the sunshine when you left. Now all I own is what was kept. Every heartbeat says your name, but nothing ever feels the same. I still wait, but we said.
Okay, let's see where we go from here. We're going to finish up on the Lavrov end. But before we finish up with that, I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, since the mediation allegedly, you know, that Russia is allegedly being told to wait for Witkoff and Kushner. Apparently, they're off when they're not buying things and making personal fortunes. They're out trying to settle conflicts around the world. And although arguably that's pretty much gone, peace president has gone to Big Bad Wolf instead, and he's in charge of the planet destruction. What did he say over the weekend? This was great. Over the weekend, he said, I forget who he was in front of, but he said that he expected, he anticipated naming the Strait of Hormuz a U.S. territory. Yeah, international law, the sea be damned. That's a U.S. territory. I'm taking it, you know, and if put me in coach wants to take Cuba, well, let him, and we can install Marco Cubio as the guy in charge of Cuba. Cubio, get it? That was humor. That was a joke. So, and only put me in coach can install Cubio as the president of both Venezuela and Cuba. And we'll just put blockades out wherever we want in contravention of the international law of the sea. None of that matters as long as Witkoff and Kushner get to buy basketball teams and FIFA percentages. You know, this is how it goes. And by the way, this isn't part of Lavrov's deal, but it you know, Trump's. Remember when Trump first took office? It was all about, hey, my war, it's Biden's war. Well, I don't think that's true anymore, you know, especially given that Biden, for his part, resisted heavily giving Zelensky, the Green Goblin and crew, ability to strike deep inside Russia, intelligence, attackums, anything, you know, any of the United States technology, or making it clear that jumping into deep strikes inside of Russia means the U.S. is helping, or England, but England has the same intelligence the U.S. has. They're using U.S. stuff. They don't have their own stuff, you know. They do, but nowhere near that we share with NATO, and so NATO is sharing with Ukraine, and Ukraine is using that shared intelligence to attack deep inside of Russia. So the smartest move would have been, as I've been very consistent in saying, for Trump to back the hell out. And it looked like he was going to for a little bit. I know there's no personal, like of the Green Goblin from the Trump side. You know, he used to be fond of saying, I inherited this war, it's not mine, but I inherited the war. He could still say that. It's not his war, but that's different from saying, I bear no responsibility for what my administration subsequently chose to do in that war. He's made it worse. The longer the administration owns the policy, the weaker his inherited defense, that's Biden's war, not mine, the weaker that becomes. And that should certainly be pointed out far more often than it is. So allegedly, Turkey wants to mediate, but mainly in its own interest, because it's losing grain and the ability to operate in the Black Sea. And it's trying to mediate between... trying to say, well, gee, Ukraine, sorry for blowing up all your grain ships in the Azov Sea, but, you know, don't blow up all their grain ships, because that's going to harm us in Turkey. Now, by the way, it also harmed Turkey for Ukraine to take out all the Russian grain ships, because Turkey still buys a lot of grain from Russia. And there was a deal, even during the war, to leave those
dry goods ships alone on both sides. Ukraine broke it, destroyed a whole bunch of ships in the Azov Sea, to great pleasure in broadcasting to the West that look what we've done. And now that Russia has retaliated by destroying, basically, the port of Odessa, destroying their ability to export grain of their own or to dry goods of their own or to import anything into Odessa, suddenly it's a problem. But, you know, okay, sorry, we're sorry we shouldn't have done that, but you blew up all the ships. Why in the world would Russia agree to anything? And they're not going to. So the question that was given to Lavrov was, Turkey wants to mediate, but Erdogan signs NATO documents supporting Ukraine. Can Russia trust Turkey as a mediator? And so Lavrov said, well, you know, interestingly, Turkey wants several things at the same time. They want NATO membership. They want a relationship with Europe, but they also want decent relationship with Russia. And they want economic cooperation with Russia. They have it anyway. The biggest destination for Russian tourism is Turkey. The Russians everywhere, Turkey. And that's not going to change. Well, it could change, but they want Black Sea stability. They want the ability to deal with Russia in the Sea of Azov and the Black Sea. And Lavrov says that Turkey understands deep down, and this was interesting for him to say, that it will never be admitted into the EU and that Russia and Turkey share enormous economic and geographic interests, but that there is a contradiction. Turkey wants agreements protecting Black Sea shipping, but they already had that agreement and Ukraine broke it. They're trying to get them to come back in. Lavrov says, and I knew about these, but I didn't know until Lavrov said about the civilian vessels. And I knew about the Caspian Pipeline Consortium. That's actually American companies. And that allegedly Trump is mad with on behalf of large interests because of this Caspian Pipeline Consortium, which is like Shell, Chevron, one of the biggies, that comes out through Azerbaijan, Armenia, through that route into the Black Sea. And he's saying that Ukraine striking those ships has created a real problem. And then some of these are Turkish civilian vessels and infrastructure, and neither Turkey nor America has publicly condemned Ukraine, but privately telling Moscow, they're saying to Moscow, all right, well, we'll send Kyiv a signal that you can't keep this up in the Black Sea, but Russia, you need to back off of Odessa and let them ship their grain. And Russia's going, I don't think so. And so Zelensky isn't promising to stop attacks altogether. And instead, they promised to avoid ships having no connection to Russia. So he's saying Turkey is Turkey and it has its own interests, and we're not going to get involved in their interest, and they're not going to get involved in ours against Ukraine. That's a big deal, actually. So then they asked him some personal questions, and I don't know. I was interested in it, but I'm not so sure anybody else would be, because I happen to like him. And there were so I'll skip those three, four questions. And he said the final question was this: Russia is going through a difficult period right now, and people need strong words and leadership. What would you like to tell them? And Lavrov initially rejected the premise that Russia needs some, you know, stirring commentary from him. He said Russians already hear strong words regularly from their leadership. And Putin has clearly said that all objectives of the special military operation will be achieved. And Lavrov says he watches reports from the front himself and describes the soldiers as impressive, precise, and proud of their country. Then he's the traditional formulation he then talks about. And basically, it's the same repetition
all the way through. They always say this. Any leader says basically the same thing. The enemy will be defeated, victory will be ours, and our cause is just. And then he said he'd like to finish with a joke, and he says, if you want to add, you know, my personal take on that, he said, I'd like to tell it to you, but I'm afraid on TV they'd have to bleep it out. So that's his joke. I can't tell it to you because otherwise you'd have to bleep me. And so he ignored that part. That was pretty good, I thought. And anyway, he's a very well-spoken guy. And I like listening to him because I think he matters almost as much as Vladimir Putin when you're talking about it. I watched another Panchenka video, and that's that Diane Panchenka who has been throttled and beat up by YouTube, got rid of her 2 million followers, and now she's just starting to come back. They let her open a new channel, and it's pretty interesting. Why let her open her new channel but not let her have her old channel? So it's okay to have a small influence, but not a large one. And I wanted to talk a little bit about this because there is throttling is rampant on Western media. So I was in putting together the stuff for this morning on these links. What I do is I watch several programs, you know, and I like to watch them. Like last night I watched an evening, Voskresny, Sunday evening with Vladimir Solovyov. And it's always two and a half hours. And I most of the time watch all of it, but only on Sundays. It's on every night, but I generally only get to it on Sundays. And Sunday's a little bit different than the rest anyway. It's more comprehensive. And then I've started watching something called First Sevastopol, Channel 1 Sevastopol. Basically, and Channel 1 Sevastopol has a two times a day, like a 6 a.m. and a 6 p.m. Broadcast, about 30 to 45 minutes, depending on, you know, content. And then they have a whole bunch of little 15-minute segments by certain experts on this and on that. They talk about various things. And I don't want to say the channel is new, but it's new to YouTube, okay? And so they've started broadcasting on YouTube maybe 3 months ago, not that long ago. And I've been watching them grow. I've been watching with interest because it's from Crimea, the former, you know, Sevastopol's in the Crimea. It's former Ukrainian. And in 2014, it elected to go with Russia. And so Sevastopol is a historic Russian city, as is all of Crimea, in fact. And the Russian Navy's big down there, Russian travel big down there on the Black Sea. And Channel 1 Sevastopol has been around for a long time. And now they're breaking into YouTube. Well, just like Solovyov, they block. Just like 60 Minutes, the Russian Channel 1 Moscow is blocked or throttled. You can watch it, but you have to get creative in where to find it. So when I get on and I try to watch, especially without a VPN, used to be I could get on with a VPN and watch it, but my Russian telephone number expired and I can't, what do you call it? Two-step authentication to my Russian number any longer because that number expired. I didn't renew it when I was there last year in about 3 months, and I'd had it for a while. I didn't know it would just crap out on me, and the payment comes off of my Mir card just like, you know, it's supposed to. But apparently, since I'm a foreigner, I don't get to keep it for that long, right? And I can't have a
Russian number. So I have to get a new one when I go there the next time. I doubt I'll be able to have the same Russian telephone number, which has created a problem with me being able to log into Russian internet, which is Yandex. In here we have Google, there they have Yandex. And if I could log in a VPN into Yandex without two-step authentication, then I could get to some of these programs that I want to watch without a VPN. Well, with a VPN, and then maybe download them and use them. But I'm unable to do that through YouTube because YouTube throttles the hell out of them. And one of the big parts of this is asinine things for me. And one of the things I just don't get, I've grown up my entire life and I'm old, you know, my entire life, it's been freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom to listen to what you want to listen to, freedom of expression and ideas and all of this stuff. Unless it's coming from a place that you don't want to, you know, you can't have people hearing or understanding. So the issues are, these are real issues. YouTube is throttling or blocking direct retrieval of all kinds of stuff, like Diane Penchenka, who happens to be anti-Ukraine. And I don't understand what YouTube has to do with Ukraine or why Ukraine is so important to YouTube. But there are other topics too. But you can't go out and necessarily, without hard work, find something that is either pro-Russian or anti-Ukrainian, one of the two. They get rid of people like that. And even on a show-by-show basis, if you have a particular show that's just one show that's pro-Ukrainian, pro-Russian instead of pro-Ukrainian, they're going to block it. And it's nonsense. But it's a reality. They can't have that sort of information out there. I don't know why. You know, it makes no sense to me why YouTube would give a rip. And I can't believe that they do. But it's absolutely the case that they are throttling and blocking direct retrieval of videos that don't toe the Western line. And we're America. We're supposed to not be afraid of words. We're supposed to not be afraid of competing opinions. We're, you know, if we have a opposing view, we should be able to discuss it and each person figure out what they want to do on their own, what they choose to believe, what they choose not to. Nope, that's not allowed anymore. You have to, anything that you don't like, you can get rid of it. And people will go, yeah, but YouTube's a private organization. Is it? Or is it another arm of the deep state or has been co-opted by? I don't know. But you can't, I do know the facts say that you can never pull an evening with Vladimir Solovyov. You can't get to it. You can watch it, but then by the time the show's over, it's already been blocked. And if you haven't, even if you download it, as soon as you try to watch it again, it's gone. Access to it is blocked. I told you about the one, these were Ukrainians who were anti-government last week. That thing was blocked the next morning. It was gone. The one that showed the video of the soldiers on the front line and that I spoke about last week. This absolutely is happening. It's this is not a drill. So these episodes that you can't watch. You can't watch Pervy Sevastopolsky. You can watch it for the first day, but then you can't go back and re-download. You certainly can't download them, and you can't get a transcript of them because that transcript is violative of whatever, I don't know, content arms that they have, and it's you can't be anti-Ukraine, which is really weird, and I don't understand why it's such a big deal, but it really is. So I don't know. Russia's attempting to produce right now cumulative systemic failure. Over the weekend, there were some 2,500 drones sent into Russia. One of the big complaints on Solovyov and in other places is another bombing on a beach with, and I don't get this. I never have understood this. They're sending fragmentation explosive devices. And a fragment, basically, if you take a C4 explosive and attach a block of it to a drone, that's typical, okay? They're flying these drones deep inside of Russia with a block of C4 attached to it, and then the block of C4 will explode in a Wildberries facility, start the whole thing on fire. Those are for the destruction of objects, of infrastructure, of pipelines, of buildings, of, I don't know, bridges, whatever, you know, even a locomotive, you know, but those are not for the destruction of personnel. What is for the destruction of personnel are fragmentation grenades. And the best way to outline a fragmentation explosive is as follows. Take a larger, because it's lighter, a larger block, the size of a block, call it a double the size of a block of C4. Fill it with 10 to 15,000 BBs, steel balls, right? Little tiny ball bearings. And have those explode over a crowded beach. You're not trying to blow up any building. You're trying to maximum damage people. That is what is happening. And they've done it over beaches. They've done it in resort swimming pools. You know, where a drone, a Ukrainian drone, flies in and detonates fragmentation devices to maximize the destruction of people. Women and children, families that are vacationing in Crimea or on the beach or at other places. And it's been done repeatedly. And that is what is going on. And that is disgusting in my mind. You know, I don't agree with that. And I can't imagine anybody else would either. I've been trying to figure out, because I see the end of the war approaching myself. And I believe a lot of other people that are familiar with the realities of war are that Russia is approaching its objectives. They're at Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. They're on the doorstep. And when they get those, arguably the larger portion of the objectives of the special military operation are met. Now, right now, with the change in what's going on in Odessa and all the way up to Transnistria, which comes off of Moldova, I think there's a likelihood that it'll continue until they take Mykolaiv and Odessa as well. I think it'll expand to that and cut Ukraine off from the Black Sea entirely, so that Russia doesn't, you know, so that the permanent settlement is far more likely if Ukraine is cut off from the sea. Unless Ukraine's going to spend the rest of its days doing nothing but sending drones into Russia, as if that's going to change something. It's not going to. And I believe that as we get closer and closer to the end of the initial objectives of the special military operation, that I'm trying to figure out on my own, how does this war actually end? And Is Russia attempting to produce a cumulative systemic failure in Ukraine rather than any sort of spectacular battlefield breakthrough? I think that's partially true because Russia is heavily bombing Ukraine every single night. The story is Ukraine sending 1,000 drones into Russia each and every night. But Russia's sending 1,000 drones into Russia with the vast majority being shot down. And Russia's sending in 100 to 150 missiles, none of which are being shot down because Ukraine has no remaining air defenses. Those are a completely different story. First of all, a block of C4 doesn't do what a missile can do coming from Russia, right? So the destruction in Ukraine is far worse than any destruction being thrown out in Russia. But all you hear about is the Russian destruction. You don't hear crap about what's gone on in Ukraine. You don't hear about the logistics nightmare of Ukraine. All you hear is Fox News. There was one over the weekend, in fact. I was like, Jesus, what the hell? What a bunch of lies. They get on there and go, look, and all they talk about is, look at Ukraine striking deep inside of Russia. That's it? You're not going to say anything about the opposite side? Not a word. Not a word. That, oh, by the way, there is zero air defense in Ukraine anymore. I mean none. And Russia's hitting anything they want to hit. And Ukraine is losing heavy. And they're losing kilometers daily. And nobody's even mentioned it. So it's, you know, that is this cumulative systemic failures. You know, what's going to happen this winter? In all seriousness, what's going to happen? Ukraine has no infrastructure to deliver food, water, anything. Ukraine has no energy. They have no gas that they used to get for free from Russia. And so they can't supply their own. And even if they could, now all the pipelines are destroyed. They can't provide electricity. They have no trains. They're losing all their locomotives. Their airfields are on the way out. Water supply is going to be bad. They're not going to be able to provide warmth for their population. There are many, many, many negatives that are going to come out in this winter. And the colder, and it gets cold quick over there. And when it does, I'm interested in seeing what happens then. You know, is Ukraine's, will Ukraine still just, you know, be like the fly on the rear end of a mule? You know, this drone campaign, is it going to change the strategic balance? I don't think so. It's just, you know, is it just going to impose some costs but not alter the underlying military equation? I don't think it's changing anything, even now. Now, people in the West would have you believe otherwise, but I don't believe that. And, you know, Russia had shared through Putin, as I discussed in the Lavrov segment, about the Alaska settlement that Trump offered through Witkoff and Kushner a year ago prior to the Alaska was acceptable, negotiated outcome. Wasn't Russia's favorite, but it was acceptable. And then immediately that was all poo-pooed and everybody came to, oh, geez, we can't do that. And, you know, Trump said, all right, I'm out. You know, and he hasn't done much except leave the neocons, you know, back in charge and the Kushner. What will Kiev realistically accept? The Lord knows. They got a guy who hasn't been a legitimate ruler already for a couple and a half years. And, you know, what are they going to do? If neither side formally accepts any terms, doesn't really matter because Ukraine's military economic position continues to deteriorate far faster than Russia's. And Russia can withstand a hell of a lot more. So the strikes are what's important to discuss. You know, Ukraine has demonstrated that its comparatively inexpensive drones can still penetrate deeply, especially with the help of U.S. and British intelligence, and impose economic costs on Russia and destroy stuff. That does matter. But the fact that they can do this isn't necessarily strategic symmetry. Hitting Russia with drones is nowhere near the equivalent to possessing Russia's volume and variety of drones, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and heavy strike systems, artillery. The meaningful question isn't whether can Ukraine hit Russia. It's whether, you know, we know it can, but whether those attacks make any difference or not, materially affect Russia's capacity or the willingness to continue the war faster than Russian strikes to degrade Ukraine's capacity to continue. I mean, that's a legitimate comparison. Ukraine is losing the ability to continue, and it's making it difficult for them to proceed. There's no doubt. So I don't know. It's when you talk about the how long will it take before the narrative that the West is pumping sunshine up people's rear ends, how long can it survive if the population of Ukraine finally capitulates? There's a serious manpower problem, and you don't have to listen to outside voices. Listen to Ukraine. Ukraine's own defense minister, Mykhailo Fyodorov, said in January 2026 that 200,000 Ukrainian servicemen were AWOL, away without official leave, or absent without official leave, depending on your service branch. And along with 2 million people that were wanted in connection with their draft dodging. So 2,200,000 Ukrainian servicemen not present that otherwise should have been, right? The Ukrainian prosecutor general recorded more than 310,000 AWOL desertion criminal charges through October 2025. And so Ukraine stopped publicly releasing these statistics recently, and certainly since the first quarter of this year after Fyodorov, because now they're worried about wartime. You know, you can't release these numbers during wartime. People will know that, you know, we're experiencing serious manpower problems. We can't have that. How's YouTube going to throttle that if Ukraine's own defense ministry is saying these numbers? They can't really do that. Hard to say that you can, you know, you can. There was the show I watched the other day. Remember that one? That the Ukrainians and the talking about the Ukrainians on the front line that needed the help, and the war that you're not allowed to see that was immediately blocked from YouTube. That those two guys said that 1,500 a day were going Romania, 1,500 Bulgaria, 1,500 people Hungary. That's 5,000, not per day, I'm sorry, every couple of 3 days, you know, that were going out. So they were equating that to 500,000 a year is what they were equating it to. Not me, them. And that's what they were saying. And I don't know that to be true, but there aren't that many. The numbers of Ukrainians in Ukraine is probably less than the numbers that are outside of Ukraine right now from the start of the special military operation in 2022 to the present. I'll bet you the number is less than half of what it was that time. I've been following those numbers for 3-4 years now. And it's not good. The numbers are not good. And so I think there are two wars taking place inside of Ukraine. There's a physical war, missiles, drones, artillery, men, logistics, ports, you know, electricity, fuel, and territory. And the other one's the informational war, the war that determines which of those things you're supposed to notice. The second war is far more interesting to me because if you watch Western TV, you can very easily, or YouTube, you can very easily come away believing that the defining military developments right now is that Ukraine is winning. They're not. They're sending drones hundreds of kilometers into Russia. Those attacks are very real. They're not imaginary. They are causing damage. Russians are killed with fragmentation grenades. Industrial installations are being hit. Refineries, logistics are being attacked. Moscow and other cities are having to deal with the reality of war. And Ukraine is pretty proficient at producing and operating long-range drones and taking videos of the same or getting Russians to upload them. There was a huge segment in Solovyov that said there were a group of people that are taking these videos, uploading them, and selling them to some Ukrainian guy in Italy, and they want those people to be charged with felonies for selling this data to Ukrainian national in Italy for money, because they're using that as part of the damage assessments and stuff like that. And all these things matter, but there's a bigger question that nobody seems to be interested, at least in the West. Does it matter, any of this stuff, to the real outcome of the war? That's an entirely different question than what is being presented. Burning Russian warehouses, make a great TV picture. Destroying a Russian refinery could be a nice headline. A drone arriving in Moscow is a psychological impact, you know. Now, you'll never see, except on Russian TV or Ukrainian telegram channels, you'll never see publicly that they are using fragmentation grenades over beaches, because that's not popular. You know, you can't do that. People wouldn't like that. Wars are not decided, though, by which side produces the most dramatic television pictures on Monday morning. Wars are decided by whether a side retains men, weapons, industry, logistics, economy, and the political cohesion necessary to keep on fighting. And when we look at that question, reality should be much less comfortable for the Ukrainians. Over the past week, Zelensky's own accounting described more than 1,500 Russian drone strikes, another 1,500 aerial bombs and 62 missiles striking targets across 13 regions. That's a big deal. They've stopped reporting on that as well. All they want to hear is Ukraine is striking inside of Russia. But what did it accomplish? Did it stop Russian industrial production? Did it prevent Russia from fielding additional forces? Is it stopping Russian missile production? Is it significantly interrupting the Russian offensives on the front? All of these are no, by the way. Is it materially altering a territorial situation? Is it forcing Moscow to change its negotiating position? These are the important questions. And then look around what's happening inside of Ukraine. Ports around Odessa and Izmaila are under enormous pressure or not working at all. Logistics facilities are struck. Bridges are destroyed. Industrial facilities are destroyed. Factories are being bombed and destroyed. Air defense ammunition is gone. And manpower is probably the most serious problem of them all. They acknowledge they don't have anybody left. Does this mean that some people aren't, that they're not going to be able to field it for a little bit more? I don't know, but the end is approaching. And I think you can watch some of these videos and see where we're going. It'll be interesting to find out what happens when the end is upon us. I very much appreciate you listening to the show this morning. I hope you join in every day from 7:30 a.m. to 9 a.m. Central Standard Time here at Dam Radio. Once again, I am Samuel Trapp, coming to you live from the Lake Ozark Real Estate of the Art Studio. You can listen to us live every day, damradio.com/live, and listen to our prior shows by going out to internationalflavor.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and have a very good day.